Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Hellett, and it has been, to say the least, an eventful news week in Louisville, Frankfort, Indiana, and beyond. So let's get right to it. We begin with our WFPL News Roundtable, minus one. Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, and Devin Katayama are here. Welcome all.
Thanks
for
being
here.
Philip Bailey will be back with us next week. We welcome your input, 502-814-TALK. That's 502-814-8255. Toll free, 1-877-814-TALK. 1-877-814-8255. You can email us at news@wfpl.org. Send us a tweet if you'd like at WFPL News, or reach us through our Facebook page. Let's start with you, Devin. Two big stories yesterday involving the Kentucky State Fair Board. First of all, new life for the amusement park formerly called Kentucky Kingdom. Big news yesterday regarding Kentucky Kingdom.
Yeah, this proposal came through rather quickly. The Cook family, who owns the Indiana's Holiday World, Splash USA, they proposed to take over essentially Kentucky Kingdom. So there was a big vote yesterday by the Fair Board, which approved of the 50-year lease for the family to do so. So you're going to be seeing a lot of change there, hopefully, in the near future. Mid-April is when they're starting to think about actually doing some construction and making certain changes and starting to do the first hires. There was a lot of speculation around this. We didn't really know if this was going to be accepted. Previous proposals had fallen through last year, but this they really came through with a strong presentation. Everyone in the Fair Board unanimously approved of allowing them to essentially remake Kentucky Kingdom, which will no longer, by the way, be called Kentucky Kingdom. It will be Bluegrass Boardwalk, which according to some people, they're not too happy about, but that's the name that they settled on.
Now, the Cook family has had a lot of success with Holiday World and the water park there in southern Indiana. Are they promising something a little different here in Louisville?
Interesting. They're going to continue the same family values kind of ambiance that the other parks have. So they'll have the free drinks. They'll have the suntan lotion, so they say. So they are really trying to transfer the Holiday World kind of ideas onto Kentucky Kingdom. Obviously, the park is a little bit different. They say once they start with the initial investment of $15 to $20 million that they do intend on expanding the park. It's on a slightly smaller amount of land than Holiday World, I believe 60 acres or just over 60 acres on the old Kentucky Kingdom property. But it seems like they would like to expand eventually.
Now, the previous negotiations with the board were with Ed Hart, Louisville businessman who once ran Kentucky Kingdom. And he was asking for a lot of government money, from $20 million or so from the state and some from metro government. Is the Cook family asking for some government help?
The Cook family is in the process of applying for the incentives program through the state. That will likely be solidified mid-April, which again is when they also plan to start really kind of honing in on cleaning that place up. They're also looking for a lot of private lenders, which they haven't really announced who those are, and obviously investing some of their own funds, which is part of that $15 to $20 million. Once the park is up and running, they say it'll bring around 25 full-time jobs and 800 seasonal jobs. Dan Cook, who made the presentation yesterday, says some of those jobs are probably likely to be part of Holiday World employees, but also Louisville employees.
As I stated in the meeting, the construction persons will begin in April, middle of April, when we start painting and taking out pumps and doing restorations, repairs to buildings. So it's going to be middle of April. We're going to start bringing some people from Santa Claus, but a lot of people from Louisville, because it's a long commute. So the vast majority we're going to bring in are going to be Louisville jobs.
And the part of that lease also is a base rent of $400,000. That will increase until 2016, when it remains at $1 million thereafter. And there is some revenue streams, some consistent revenue streams that's built into the lease contract.
And the lease approved by the State Fair Board, which has had the same full-time president, Harold Workman, familiar name around here. He's been around for 20 years or so. But it was disclosed this week that there is some sort of effort to remove him from that post. What's going on?
Yeah, there was a lot of rumors speculated. There was a lot of media yesterday at the Fair Board meeting, one of the most packed meetings that they say that they've seen. Part of that is that the board and workmen have had differences in opinions. Board Chair Ron Carmichael said it wasn't as much to do with workmen's job performance, just the ideas that, I guess, that clashed with him and the board. And there was speculation and accusations that Carmichael called some board members and was actually called by Bashir or spoke with Bashir himself and was relaying a Bashir message to board members that that they vote to oust Workman. And that was expected, or that was a rumor to be expected at Thursday's meeting. Carmichael says that he really talked about the rumors and said that board member, he didn't really call any board members to oust them at all.
Yeah, I want to say that I have not politicked or campaigned on this. I tried to be a chairman and make a decision to lead. And people's statements, comments get made. The only phone calls I ever made to a board member was courtesy to know that there was a difference of opinion and there may be an issue. And I don't think board members should be in this community and walk out and have to answer questions and not know that something may be going on. And if it were perceived as trying to line up support for an opinion, my job as chairman is not to be to provide the opinions. My job as chairman is to provide leadership, deal with the issues, and what I would expect the board members to do is to come sit at this table, listen to the facts, and make a decision. That's our job. We're all volunteers.
And Carmichael was really emotional. You could hear it in his voice.
Yeah.
He was like that for the whole roughly 15 minutes that the media spoke with him. He was almost breaking out in tears. You could see it in his eyes. He had a very sensitive issue around the subject. What they did, they actually went into executive session after the Kentucky Kingdom presentation. They talked about it for over an hour, a personnel matter. They didn't really discuss what that was. But when they came back to regular session, they unanimously approved of looking for a new chief financial officer. This was not to replace Workman in any way. It's to assist them in creating a long-term business plan. Now, part of that seems to be along the lines of going a different path than what Workman might have kind of proposed or helped them develop. And Carmichael also said that they were looking at an exit strategy or would like to plan an exit strategy for when Workman does leave. At that time, he didn't say when that might be.
His contract, I think, runs through the end of June, so
right.
It's a possibility there, but he's here at least until then.
Right.
All right. Thanks, Devin. Gabe Buller, we're going to turn to you here on the State of the News. We began the week with the big news that Mayor Greg Fisher has chosen a new chief of police for Louisville Metro.
Yeah, this announcement came out on Monday, and Philip Bailey covered this as well, but we were all kind of watching this for a while. Chief White left for Denver. He's the chief of police in Denver now. He left last year, and the search began for a new police chief. Mayor Fisher has appointed Steve Conrad to be the new chief. Conrad, like all the other finalists for the job, either had experience with the Louisville Metro Police Department or with a nearby force. We saw the chief of Owensboro, the chief of Jefferson Town, and also some LMPD staffers. Well, Conrad was an assistant chief with the LMPD for a while. He left for a job in Glendale, Arizona, where he's the chief, and that force is a little bit smaller than the Louisville force, but the mayor went to meet with him over the weekend and had offered him the job.
And he is going to be starting, what, next month?
Yeah, he'll be starting next month. So far, he said that he's preparing for this. He was in town over the last few days before he went back to Arizona to finish up a few things back there. But he says he wants to make Louisville the safest city in America when he starts. And so far, he's said that he would like the current command staff to stay on, but he hasn't committed to any other changes just yet. We'll be watching those once he comes in on March 19th, I think.
And he made it clear that he will not be a continuation of Chief White. He is his own man. He will have his own policies and procedures.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't want to just continue the status quo, and that's all part of his plan to make Louisville the safest or one of the safest cities in the country, and he'll start rolling out a lot of these plans once he starts in late March.
All right. Thanks, Gabe. Erica Peterson, WFPL Environment Reporter. You reported this week on a new study suggesting there are other causes for health disparities in Appalachia, I'm assuming other than the coal industry.
Coal mining, yeah.
Yeah, well, tell me about the study.
Well, it was a study that didn't get a whole lot of media attention, but a couple of people did report on it. It's a study that was funded by the National Mining Association. So that's the first thing. It was funded by a coal mining lobbying organization. But it was done by researchers at Yale University's School of Public Health. And they made it clear, you know, where they got their money from. The National Mining Association didn't have any control over how the study was performed. And And according to Dr. Jonathan Borak, the lead researcher, they didn't even get to see the results of the study before they were published. And the study was published in a peer-reviewed journal. So, you know, it was seen as valid by at least the people in the peer-reviewed journal who looked at it and published it. And what they... And what they found basically is they didn't come down to Appalachia and do research on the ground, but they analyzed statistics from various governmental organizations and basically concluded that the health disparities in the region cannot be directly tied to the coal industry.
And is the study in direct response to other studies that have been conducted that kind of indict the coal industry?
Yes. There have been a number of studies out of West Virginia University by Michael Hendricks, and those have suggested that the coal industry, and in particular mountaintop removal, are directly responsible for some of the health problems, like birth defects and cancers, things like that in Appalachia.
So does this let mining companies off the hook?
No, not at all. And Dr. Borak made it very clear that that was not what he wanted people to get out of this. I mean, pretty much his conclusion was that there are a lot of things going wrong in Appalachia, and the coal industry is probably indirectly responsible for a lot of them, a lot of cultural factors, a lot of geographical factors that contribute to things like high levels of obesity and diabetes, poor access to health care, things like that. And his call was that the coal industry should be concerned about this. They should want their workforce and their communities to be healthier and should take a more active role in helping rectify some of these disparities.
Has there been any response from the National Mining Association?
No, they have not mentioned this study. They have, as of a couple minutes ago, at least, there had been no press release issued by them kind of touting the results of it. So, I mean, I guess that would lead one to conclude that it didn't say exactly what they had hoped it would and you know, and aren't trumpeting these results just yet.
All right, Erica, thank you. Go back to Devin Katayama. You visited with Senator Rand Paul this week, who made a stop in Louisville. First of all, he is asking the Supreme Court now to uphold a circuit court's decision that the new federal health care law is unconstitutional.
Yeah, he's one of several, both for and against the new health care mandates that have filed amicus briefs, which were the deadline to file was last Friday. And so I know there's at least over a dozen for both sides that filed briefs. Paul's really looked at the extension of the Commerce Clause, which he felt the federal government was using to kind of force the mandates on individuals. And the Commerce Clause, and in a specific case of Wickard versus Filburn, which kind of discussed by the circuit court, which overruled the mandates, he's looking to get that overturned. And essentially that says if commerce is being jeopardized, government can step into individual right or individuals' spaces to kind of regulate that. Paul says, obviously, that's wrong, that government shouldn't be stepping in individuals' rights. Of course, he's a doctor, so he used that card to kind of say that a lot of politicians that are voting on this aren't in the medical field. I am. So he used that as well. He was addressing the Federalist Society, the Louisville Lawyers chapter, which is why he was in town earlier this week.
Now, you also ask him on another topic, and we'll give an assist to Kenny Colston in Frankfurt over this, but you ask him about the possibility of him accepting a vice presidential nomination.
Yeah, Kenny mentioned I should just ask him whether he'd be interested in the spot, which actually earlier in this year he was asked before, so we kind of wanted to know if he was still considering that. He said he's not closing the door on the issue, that he would still consider it, or he didn't really close the door or say that he wouldn't take a spot. And then I asked him specifically if Romney would win, if he would take a spot with Romney's campaign. He said that it would essentially be an honor to be on Romney's ticket. Now, his father, Ron Paul, is also running, and he says, of course, that he's standing by his father basically 100%. But it was just interesting because Romney is going up against him, and he's in the lead in a lot of states and a lot of polls. So it was just an interesting response, and it actually got a lot of attention. Then later on, the Paul campaign responded, or not Paul campaign, but Rand Paul's office responded and said that, of course, that he would be honored if anybody offered him a spot as vice president. Who wouldn't be honored in that situation?
A Paul ticket would be interesting.
That would be an interesting ticket.
One note on the Rand Paul's vice presidential options or potential. A lot of folks have brought this up, that he would be that counterbalance on a Romney ticket, that he would bring in a lot of the Tea Party supporters, perhaps, since aside from Marco Rubio, there aren't a lot of options for someone that affiliated with the Tea Party holding an office now who could win. So it would be a pretty interesting it'll be pretty interesting to see whoever the nominee is, what they how they will end up treating both the Pauls, Ron and Rand.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks, Devin. And Gabe, Congressman John Yarmuth was in here the day before yesterday, sitting over there in Erica's chair. And you and Philip Bailey talked to him, and he talked about several issues, one being the nation's relationship with Iran.
Yeah, there's a lot of growing tension there. Iran is developing a nuclear program. They say it's just for energy. They can't really be verified. The thought is that there is some enrichment for weaponry. So there are a lot of sanctions on the country, and we're seeing even in a lot of the GOP candidate debates, the candidates are being fairly hawkish on Iran, and talk of possibly Israeli airstrikes may come about soon. And there's this threat that Iran may close down the Strait of Hormuz, that very important shipping passage for oil coming from other countries in that area. Now, a U.S. aircraft carrier just passed through the strait this week, and the tensions remain very high. Congressman Yarmuth, when he spoke with us, he said that he thinks most Iranians actually want a better relationship with the West and don't want to see this escalation of violence. It just happens that the government of Iran has not always been the best representation of what the wishes of most of the people may be. So he's watching, and certainly a lot of other folks are watching what the next diplomatic steps from the president are going to be, since this is something, one, he's being criticized on in the campaign, but also that holds a lot of weight internationally and for the future of the country. A lot of the arguments people have pointed out in favor of taking some sort of action against Iran mirror what happened, you know, 9 years ago, 10 years ago in the escalation to the war in Iraq. This talk about weapons inspections and how long that course should go through, what sort of diplomatic routes should be taken before there's any sort of military aggression.
Congressman Yarmuth also talked about some other issues, including the presidential race and his own re-election bid. And you can hear our conversation with him at WFPL.org. Before we run out of time, Erica, I want to get to you. And the Kentucky Court of Appeals reversed a decision by the State Energy and Environment Cabinet. What was the original decision?
Well, originally, residents of Wilson Creek in Floyd County petitioned the cabinet to have them declare a big chunk of land unsuitable for coal mining. And that's a petition that the cabinet can grant. And the cabinet didn't. They rejected the petition. But they said, well, we're going to reject this, but we're going to put certain restrictions on the land. So they said, you know, they can't, coal trucks couldn't use this narrow road in and out of the area. They said that they would have to reclaim the land with trees. Honestly, pretty reasonable restrictions on that. But the coal company argued that the cabinet couldn't do that, that they had to either declare that the land was unsuitable for mining or it was suitable. So the Kentucky Court of Appeals eventually did overturn the ruling and ruled in favor of the coal company.
So what does this ruling mean?
Well, so what this means is it goes back to the cabinet. And the cabinet now, the court ruled that the cabinet has to, that they can declare the land unsuitable for certain types of coal mining. And they can basically have the exact same effect as they were going for by granting the petition with restrictions on it. And so it's back in their court right now.
Any indication as what the cabinet might be doing?
No, I have emailed them every day since then, and and I'm told nothing yet. So maybe sometime next week we'll figure out if they're going to act on this.
All right, that's going to wrap up our segment with the the WFPL News Roundtable. I'm getting a little choked up here, but happy it's Friday.
It's emotional.
Yeah, it is. Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, Devin Katayama, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Kentucky Public Radio Frankfort Bureau Chief Kenny Colston. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. The Kentucky Senate has dealt a blow to Governor Beshear's proposal to allow voters to decide via constitutional amendment if they want expanded gaming in the state. And here to talk about that and other developments at the state capitol is Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston. Hello, Kenny.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, was this vote yesterday a surprise?
You know, I don't think it was. There was a lot of build up to it, but at the end of the day, I think a lot of people knew that the vote was going to be close and that it might not favor Governor Beshear. He even said himself in the lead up to all this that, you know, while he thought he had the votes, obviously he wouldn't know until the roll call was called for that vote, and obviously when it was called, they fell well short of the votes they needed to pass that constitutional amendment out of the Senate.
I mean, did they needed, what, 23 and they got 16?
That's right. In fact, David Williams, the state Senate president, pointed out that they didn't even get a majority of the Senate, which would have been, I think, 18 or 19 votes. So he kind of basically said, you know, the issue is dead. They didn't even get a majority of the votes. They didn't come close to getting what a constitutional amendment needs. So let's move on from this issue. It's been decided.
So this is over for this session? Nothing that can be like repackaged or represented, possibly?
Well, it always could be repackaged and represented. You know, State Senator Damon Thayer, the Republican senator who sponsored the bill in the Senate, says he's done with it for this session. He's not going to put it in as a floor amendment to any bill. He's not going to put it in as a committee sub or any other bill. That happens a lot in both chambers when lawmakers want a specific issue that they know won't pass. They'll kill other bills by filing their old bill that can't pass as an amendment. Thayer says he's not going to do that. House Speaker Greg Stumbo says that his chamber obviously is not going to take it up now that it's shown that it can't pass the Senate this session. It's dead for this session. Whether it's dead for good, you know, they've been discussing expanded gambling since 1994. So it's hard for me to believe that come 2013, there won't be some discussion about it again.
That's the perpetual issue in Kentucky.
Until they pass it, I guess.
That's right. So moving on to another topic. Now, you've been in the Kentucky Supreme Court this morning. They've been hearing, redistricting dispute has been presented to the court. What's going on there?
Basically, they had a hearing this morning, and it's one of the shortest court hearings I've ever been to. They heard testimony for about 45 minutes, asked a few questions of the lawyers for Legislative Research Commission, LRC, and of lawyers for the House Republicans and State Senator Kathy Stein, who originally sued over the maps. And it was fairly quick. You know, the LRC lawyers basically want two decades of precedent out the window. They told the court, ignore it, and you can set new precedent, and this is your chance to do so. And of course, lawyers for the House Republicans and Senator Stein were like, hold on a minute, there's no need to do that. This has worked just fine for 20 years. You know, you need to uphold this lower court ruling, and you need to tell the legislature to get back to drawing maps, and this time draw ones that are constitutional. And, you know, after meeting all day, the Supreme Court decided to issue a quick ruling this afternoon that says exactly that. They ruled the maps unconstitutional. They said that the legislature would have to use the 2002 maps, not the 2012 maps they through this year, but maps from 10 years ago to run in legislative districts this year, and that they would have to draw new maps, of course, according to state and federal law because of the census, that would be for 2014 and on. So they could draw those maps in this session, but with only 25 roughly legislative days left and they haven't touched the budget, that seems a little unlikely. What's more likely is that they come back in January during what's called the short session during the odd years and try to pass a map for that because it gives them a little extra year to do that. But it was very interesting. The whole process with the Supreme Court took less than 12 hours today, and we already had a ruling on redistricting. So it's kind of a wild day when it comes to that issue.
One of the other hot-button issues is a proposal to require people who need pseudoephedrine to get a doctor's prescription in order to fight these meth labs. Where do we stand on that?
Well, it was kind of interesting. Before, we thought we were going to have one crazy Ringling Brothers circus type day in the Senate yesterday because we thought that they were going to take up this PSE bill, the pseudoephedrine bill, either before or after they did gambling. But surprisingly, State Senator Robert Stivers withdrew the entire bill before they even voted on the gambling bill. He says that the debate's not dead, but he kind of conceded that having pseudoephedrine as prescription only, just that base statement, probably cannot pass the state Senate this year. So they're looking at some compromises, possibly some dosage limits. Of course, you know, this, the pharmaceutical industry has pushed this idea of having, you know, prescription only for convicted meth offenders, and having dosage limits for everyone, and, you know, not making it prescription only for everyone else. And so I don't know if they'll go that far, Senator Stivers will go that far, but they're looking at a few different options, and they'll probably run that bill through committee next week, and we'll have this debate all over again.
Also, there's a push on to add the University of Pikeville to the state university system, but the sponsors, I assume Greg Stumbo, Representative Greg Stumbo, one of the sponsors, is getting some pushback on that.
Yeah, you know, Morehead State University has really rallied against this idea of bringing UPike into the state system. They say that, you know, it's too much. It will drain money from them in the long term, because while the bill says that UPike will take coal severance tax money, Morehead really believes that sooner or later UPike will draw from the general fund like all the other public universities do. And they say, you know, in a time where we've been underfunded for the better part of a decade, do we really need to bring another state university in and really underfund everybody? And so they've really rallied against the bill. And in response, House Speaker Greg Stumbo has kind of said, you know, put some words out there that he thinks people are misleading, that they're trying to strike fear. And he went a step further this week by sending an open records request to Morehead State, wanting to know their travel expenses of their president, Wayne Andrews, wanting to know how they spend their money, their operating budget, trying to get in the nuts and bolts to see if they're really operating like they should. And it's kind of, I guess, an intimidation factor to tell Morehead, hey, you need to back off because I want UPike into the state system.
Mm. And speaking of education, there's also a bill moving through that would create an alternative diploma for special needs students, and that's very close to winning final passage, isn't it?
Yeah, all it has to do is pass the state house. It shouldn't have any problem. It soared through the state senate. It's one of these bills that, you know, we talk about a lot of these issues that are divisive, that, you know, we don't know if they're going to pass or not. This one's really kind of been a slam dunk. It would create an alternative diploma and alternative standards for special needs students so that they can get a diploma. Right now, they only get a kind of a certificate that said, yes, you were in school for this amount and you're done with high school. And, you know, this isn't for, you know, special needs students who obviously, you know, couldn't work a job or anything like that. These are for the ones that, you know, can probably work a job as an adult, who can function in society. And they want a diploma so that they can do that, so that they can get jobs, so that they can work, so they can be productive members of society. This bill would allow them to do that. There's probably going to be a House floor amendment that puts it into effect immediately for this year's graduating class. And it's really one of those bills that lawmakers are getting around and championing and saying, you know, this is good public policy.
Kenny Colston is the Frankfort Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. Kenny, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. Yesterday in Hamilton County, Indiana, a judge sentenced Charlie White to 1 year of home detention for voter fraud, theft, and other felonies. White was forced out as Indiana's Secretary of State when a jury returned those convictions early this month. And here to talk about the Charlie White case is Carrie Ritchie from the Indianapolis Star. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. This has been an interesting case over the past year or so. Let's go back to the beginning for those who may not know. White was indicted in connection with his voter registration in the 2010 primary, right?
Yes, that's correct. He used his ex-wife's home to vote in the May 2010 primary, and supposedly at that time he was living all the way on the other side of town in a townhome with his then fiance, who's now his new wife. And the charges alleged that he did that to cover up the fact that he had moved out of the Fisherstown Council district that he had represented. So he ended up being convicted on a theft charge for continuing to take his town council salary after he moved out of his district, and then voter fraud and perjury charges for using his ex-wife's home to vote in the May 2010 primary.
And he has maintained his innocence throughout, saying he had a kind of a complicated life and he was staying at his ex-wife's residence, but from time to time he didn't want to live in sin with his fiance, but he stayed over there sometimes too.
Yes, that's correct. That's what he has said throughout this entire process. He's also kind of bashed the charges that were filed against him and called them politically motivated, because a local Democrat was the one to call the prosecutor's attention to this process. However, the prosecutor handed off the case to two special prosecutors, one Republican, one Democrat, and a grand jury actually returned the indictment. So the prosecutors didn't even make the charging decision there.
Now, if I recall correctly, the verdict in this case came in like 3 o'clock in the morning on Super Bowl weekend, and the Super Bowl, of course, was in Indianapolis this year.
So, yeah.
So you got to pull the all-nighter on that one.
I did. I worked for about 22 hours straight. Came in around 2:30 in the morning, and the judge wanted to keep them there, and plus there was no place to sequester them because of the Super Bowl and hotels.
And no place to stay.
Yeah.
So he was sentenced yesterday to home detention. He had asked the judge in a last-ditch effort to be reinstated in office to reduce those felonies to misdemeanors, but the judge said no.
Yes, the judge did say no. The judge said that the fact that he had deceived the public, you know, far outweighed the mitigators in this case, which would be that he didn't have a criminal history and, you know, he was a family man, had a family to support. So the judge really said, no, you know, this was not a political case. You were treated fairly, and the judge really seemed to take issue with the fact that Charlie had gone on Fox News the day after he was convicted and gave an interview that, you know, was very critical of the verdict and the process in general.
Was it surprising to people that there was no jail time, that he got home detention?
No, that really wasn't a surprise because, you know, they were all Class C felonies, which are the lowest level. You know, he's a nonviolent person. He doesn't really pose a threat to society. He did not have a criminal record. So I think everybody was really expecting him to stay out of prison. However, the people who I talked to said, you know, there's no way that the judge is going to reduce all his felony convictions to misdemeanors.
And now there's this dispute over who should serve out the rest of his term, right?
Yes, that's true. Shortly after the election, the November 2010 election, which White won, the Democrats filed a challenge to that election and said that because White was improperly registered to vote at his ex-wife's house when he became a candidate, he was ineligible to be on the ballot. And they said that the Democratic candidate who lost to White, Vop Oseley, should take office. And the Indiana Recount Commission ruled against the Democrats. So they then appealed to the Marion County Circuit Court, and the judge ruled in favor of the Democrats and said, yes, Vop Oseley should take office because White was ineligible to be a candidate. The judge ended up staying that ruling. So White stayed in office up until his criminal convictions so that the Indiana Recount Commission and White could appeal to the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court will hear the election challenge next week, and their decision should tell us whether Vop Oseley is the rightful winner or whether Mitch Daniels will get a chance to appoint a Republican in that office.
Charlie White, of course, is a Republican. How has the Republican leadership in Indiana reacted to his indictment and all this whole mess?
You know, Mitch Daniels did call for him to at least step aside while these cases were pending, and that was, you know, winter of last year, so it's been a year, and Charlie didn't do anything about it. You know, the Republican Party itself, I feel like, has kind of tried to stay out of it. They've issued some very vague statements throughout this entire process, and their statement yesterday, again, was pretty vague, saying that, you know, they're just looking forward to a resolution to this matter. However, you know, other Republican leaders have, you know, suggested that Charlie should step aside. And actually, I think the mayor of Carmel, Indiana, put it best in a story that I did earlier this year. He said, you know, Charlie is in a very lonely place politically because no one wants their picture taken with someone who's under indictment. So I feel like that kind of sums up how most of the Republicans are feeling right now.
Carrie Ritchie's been covering the Charlie White case for the Indianapolis Star. Carrie, great job sorting all this out, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. We're going to turn now to Carrie's colleague, Chris Sikich, who covers the Indiana General Assembly and probably other stories for the Star. Chris, for the first time ever, first of all, Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
For the first time ever, a proposed statewide smoking ban has reached the floor of the Indiana Senate. That happened this week?
Yes, it's proceeded to the Senate. I expect they'll hear that next week at some point.
And this has passed the House, about half a dozen times, I guess, and for the first time it got past the Senate committee.
Yeah, the Senate chairman says that it's finally found that sweet spot with the right number of exemptions. It's a strong enough law that it's going to matter, but it's not a total ban.
So what kind of exemptions are we talking about?
Gaming places, casinos, cigar and hookah bars, retail tobacco stores. Right now, you wouldn't, if this passes, you would not be able to smoke at restaurants, bars, workplaces, public spaces.
And there's kind of there's a sunset provision for some, like bars and taverns.
Yeah, bars could be a tough sell in the Senate, especially if they decide to exempt bars that are 21 and over only. I have a feeling a lot of senators might find it a compelling reason to vote for an exemption for that.
So when will this come up in the Senate?
It's eligible Monday. It's hard to say when they'll actually call it down.
And do you anticipate any further changes on the Senate floor?
Yeah, I think they're going to go real hard to try to exempt Barrs from this ban. I think Barrs are going to be a really tough sell for a lot of senators.
Now, Governor Daniels has said he will sign a smoking ban, but he wants as few exemptions as possible.
He has, and it's up to the legislature, it sounds like, to decide how many exemptions that is. He hasn't weighed in specifically on whether Barrs should be exempted.
And how many? Do you know how many other states have statewide smoking bans?
I believe there are 22 states that have smoking bans that include Barrs.
I see. So has there been any outcry? I mean, I know there was quite a bit of testimony before the Senate committee yesterday from bar owners. Or who's speaking out against this the most?
Well, right now it's the bar owners, and they're saying that it should be a matter of choice for their customers, and it should be a matter of choice for business owners. They don't want the government to interfere with whether they can allow smoking in their bars. But then on the other side of it, people say it's about a matter of public health, especially for the workers in bars, not even so much for the patrons, because they can choose to go to a bar that's smoking or not smoking. But if you have a job at a bar, you don't have that choice.
I see. Moving on to another topic, you reported this week about an Indiana House panel has given the go-ahead to a bill that would crack down on some specialty license plates. What's that about?
Yeah, that one kind of came out of nowhere at the last minute, and they amended it into a different bill. There is a representative who feels the BMV has not aggressively enough discontinued license plates that don't sell and hasn't monitored the groups that get these special license plates. So he wants to put it back in the control of state lawmakers. Under this legislation, anybody who didn't sell 1,000 last year and anybody who was approved this year would lose their license plate as soon as it's signed. So the NRA would lose theirs, so would the Indianapolis Zoo. And then next year, the lawmakers would have to introduce a bill for each license plate that gets suggested.
And this is clear to House committee. What do you think its chances are in the full House?
You know, it's really hard to say. The chairman of the committee is the one who proposed it, so they voted it out of the committee to the full floor, but several people raised concerns about the legality of, say, canceling five-year contracts. You know, if a nonprofit has a five-year contract with the state for a license plate, can you just cancel that because of a piece of legislation? So I'm not sure where this is going to go on the House floor, and even if the House approves it, it's a change to a Senate bill, so it would have to go to a House-Senate committee for a final resolution.
And finally, there's been some legislation emerge in the General Assembly as a result of the tragic stage collapse at the Indiana State Fair last year.
Yes, there's a couple of bills moving forward. One would provide $6 million, an additional $6 million for the victims. So far, $5 million has already been distributed. That seems to have broad bipartisan support. That should come up to a vote in the full Senate next week. And then there's another piece of legislation that regulates the installation of the rigging at these stages. Right now, no state agency is responsible for examining this equipment at these outdoor concerts. And so this bill would put it in the hands of the state fire marshal.
And there are several investigations still ongoing from this.
Yeah, there's two reports. They're both due in April. So the legislation they passed would take effect for 2 years, and then the lawmakers want to take a look at these reports and see if something stronger is needed, then they could do new legislation next year.
All right. Chris Sikich is covering the Indiana General Assembly for the Indianapolis Star. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It's time for another break. When we come back, we'll talk Southern Indiana news with News and Tribune editor Shay Van Hoy. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, in recent weeks, rumors have been flying that Amazon.com, the big online retailer, will build a huge distribution center in southern Indiana. And I think the project even has a code name, Project Tango. Here to help us sort it all out is Shay Van Hoy, editor of the News and Tribune, Southern Indiana. Hi, Shay.
Hey, Rick. How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Well, if this is all true and indications seem to point to it being true, where would the center be located?
They're moving dirt at River Ridge Commerce Center, which is partially in Jeffersonville, and it stretches along Indiana 62 between Jeffersonville and Charlestown, the former Indiana Army ammunition plant. And so work's being done there, and basically the approvals from various city boards in Jeff and at River Ridge, the development authority there, which has control over development at the Commerce Center, have approved this. It's just, I think, maybe the worst kept secret in the world once it it's announced. And I personally think it's awesome that they came up with a code name for it of Project Tango. So we're talking about peak times, 3,200 jobs. At normal, of course, Amazon, as any retailer, over the holiday seasons when they would ramp up their employment. And during normal times, it'd be 800 employees per shift working two shifts. So even in the off-peak time, you're talking about 1,600 employees, and they have some other distribution centers in Indiana, so it wouldn't be breaking new ground as far as the state and their relationship with the company.
What is it with the cloak and dagger stuff? They're just waiting to get all the governmental permits and whatnot lined up?
Yeah, I think so. And it's weird. Amazon, I wrote something about this the other day. Amazon, you put in calls, not just us, but other, obviously all the media have been trying to get some information out of Amazon, and they're simply not returning calls, not even no comment. They're just not calling back at all. And I know that one of the steps is to try to get some grant money, and that's still in the works, and it looks promising. The grant total and the match from River Ridge would be $4.6 million, and would help also with some of the infrastructure work that they need to do for such a massive warehouse.
Now, officials in southern Indiana also courting a pharmaceutical company that could create several hundred jobs.
Yeah, and that could go hand in hand with Amazon, as it appears that a pharmaceutical company is looking at River Ridge as well. And if any of the listeners know anything about River Ridge, it's a huge amount of property, really close to the river. And if and when the East End Bridge is built, will be right there near Utica. So it's a pharmaceutical company called Areva. They were also eyeing Clarksville, but apparently at least the former Value City department store site is off for now. The town of Clarksville wants to buy that property for parking related to their Little League park, which has been built in the last couple of years.
And you may have said this, but this would be a distribution center as well.
It looks like the Areva builds builds sterile injectables, and they're based in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. We put calls into their headquarters yesterday too, and didn't hear back. But yeah, it would be some sort of production distribution center, I think.
And sticking with economic development, we learned yesterday that Jody Wassmer is stepping down as CEO of One Southern Indiana, which is your Chamber of Commerce there in the area.
Correct.
After, just 4 months on the job?
Yeah, he was hired in October. One Southern Indiana was formed from some various organizations, the former Chamber of Commerce in Clark and Floyd counties, and a couple other development organizations. And they'd previously only had one leader. They were formed in 2006, I think. And Michael Dalby moved here from Texas to take over that job, mm-hmm. was here until the middle of 2011 and left for a similar job in Columbus. And Jody Wassmer took over. He was had a similar position in Owensboro, Kentucky. And right when he hired, there was some controversy because he had a lawsuit against him by a former employee of the chamber, which was actually eventually dismissed. Didn't go any farther than just some accusations. But only being here 4 years, I went to their annual meeting, which was last week, a week ago today. He spoke at the meeting, was very positive about Southern Indiana and the outlook for the region. And they've just developed a new strategic plan, which he had a hand in as well. And then all of a sudden, he announces he's leaving. It's just odd, really all I can say. What we've been told, the official company line is it was just for personal reasons to get back to Owensboro. He still mm-hmm. has a house there to spend more time with family, and that very well may be it. But to make that move and then four months later go back to where you were already living, and he says he doesn't have any interest in the former job, which is still open in Owensboro.
All right. And also, one of the more sordid and sensational criminal cases in recent years in southern Indiana is about to get some more attention. The third trial is coming up for former state trooper David Cam.
Yeah, and the new news this week on that is a special prosecutor has been appointed, someone that we've had his name in our paper before. His name's Stan Levko, and he was recently defeated as the Vandenberg County prosecutor, but he's prosecuted some high-profile cases in the past, murder cases involving families, very similar to what David Cam will be on trial for the third time. Of course, He's been convicted twice, and both convictions have been overturned for the murders of his wife and their two children in 2000 in Georgetown. So it's something that's 12 years old at this point. But the reason that it got to the new prosecutor was Keith Henderson was basically removed from the case. It boils down to the fact that he wrote or had a book deal in place to write about the second case before all the second trial before all the appeals were exhausted. So he was removed because basically they said it was a conflict of interest is what it amounts to.
And to end on a positive note with you, I noticed a little spring in your step when you came up because the Sherman Mitten Bridge is now back open.
Yeah, that's and we you know, the news of the year so far probably for yeah. Southern Indiana especially those folks in New Albany. Great news for restaurants, retailers.
Yeah, a big relief.
Yeah, for sure. Folks. And so there's events coming up. Horseshoe has an event this weekend, a party, and then there are also some events planned for downtown New Albany.
All right. Shay Van Hoy is the editor of the News and Tribune in Southern Indiana. Shay, thanks for joining us. We turn now to Ann Marshall from Leo. A complaint has been filed with the U.S. Department of Education Office of Civil Rights claiming that Jefferson County Public Schools has not adequately addressed racial disparity when it comes to imposing discipline. That disparity is the focus of a cover story in Leo Weekly this week, and it is authored by Ann Marshall. Ann, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You bet. Let's talk about this disparity. Leo's been reviewing some data, and even though African-American kids make up about a third of the high school population, mm-hmm. I think you reported, 62% of the suspensions last year went to African-Americans.
That's right. That's in the high school population. But if you look back, even back to kindergarten, you know, there is a disparity consistent throughout the grades and throughout several years as well. And, you know, this has been an ongoing issue for districts across the country for several decades, even. This complaint that was filed back in May, and just a brief history there. There were some lawyers and advocates that were concerned on this issue and approached a researcher at UK to look at some data and identify the top 10 districts with the highest disproportionality rate in discipline when it comes to race and special education students. And JCPS topped that list. And there were some negotiations to try to come up with some sort of resolution or settlement before any complaint was filed. But JCPS felt that they were doing enough on this issue. And so as it stands right now, the complaint has been filed and investigators from the Office for Civil Rights is now looking into the discipline practices of JCPS.
Has the school district offered any official reason for this disparity?
You know, this is such a complex issue.
Yeah.
You know, and everyone, you know, agrees that there's no panacea to you know, make this go away. And, you know, there have been attempts on JCPS's part to try to address issues of, you know, cultural sensitivity or, you know, really try to help kids who are going through a difficult time. You know, they have a lot of students in JCPS who are from low-income and working families, and a lot of research has shown that those children are more susceptible to being anxious or exhibiting aggressive behavior, also just struggling in school. So, you know, that's an issue as well. You know, kids don't show up to school and leave everything behind at home. So, you know, I think JCPS has a lot to deal with when it comes to this issue. And, you know, this complaint also came at a time that was a transition for JCPS with Sheldon Berman leaving and Dr. Huggins coming in. So there might be some, you know, changes coming ahead on ways to at least improve on this issue.
Dr. Berman now in Oregon,
that's
but you
mm-hmm.
talked to him about this.
Yeah, I did. And, you know, he said that he had brought a program that dealt a lot with social and emotional learning is how he spoke of it. You know, not just sitting kids down in a seat, but realizing that maybe there might need to be some extra attention there to get them ready for the classroom. And that program did show some success with reducing discipline problems in minority students as well. It has been partially implemented, my understanding is, in middle schools, but, you know, there's still a there is the focus of the complaint was in middle school and high school students. So how that program could be transferred to other grades, you know, I'm not really sure. But, you know, he felt that his program was adequate. He did not feel that the remedies that were being put on the table by some of the lawyers and advocates behind the complaint were necessarily any better than what was in place.
About 30 seconds or so. What's the status of this complaint now?
As of right now, investigators from the Office for Civil Rights are looking into the discipline practices. And, you know, what people behind the complaint are most asking for is just to look at the current policies and see if there can be some reform that can improve this issue. They're not, you know, saying that this is, you know, intentional bias, but maybe there should be some structural improvements.
All right. Ann Marshall writes about discipline and race at GCPS in this week's issue of Leo Weekly, available everywhere and at leoweekly.com. Ann, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today's program. State of the News is produced by the WFPL News staff, which includes Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, Devin Katayama, Philip M. Bailey, and Graham Shelby. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. For more information about topics discussed today or to hear our program again, visit our website, WFPL.org. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening, and have a good weekend.